Shape of Justice, our theme for the morning. I'm delighted to be with you, my first time in Nashville, I think. And a chance to connect again with Steve, whom I remember as a young seminarian playing Dan Berrigan, if I recall, in the trial of Gainesville 9. It's always a challenge to speak to a new congregation, and so I'm reminded of the words of Mark Twain and share them with you at the outset of this sermon. I have never heard a sermon from which I have not derived some good, but there have been some near misses. I'm glad you laughed because now I'm going to indulge myself and punish you with a little song. Now, some Rochester, former Rochester parishioners here who know I'm musically challenged, but since my musical wife is not here, it falls to me to introduce this sermon briefly musically. Oh, Jonah, he lived in a whale. Oh, Jonah, he lived in a whale. He made his home in that fish's abdomen. Oh, Jonah, he lived in a whale. Well, I'm no Tess George. I've heard Tess George, and I know I'm not that talented. But I did want to introduce you to Jonah, one of the great allegories of religious literature. No doubt, being a Unitarian Universalist congregation, you are biblically astute and informed. But just in case, you may remember the story from the Hebrew Scriptures. The Lord commands Jonah to go and prophesy to the evil residents of the city of Nineveh. Jonah, a successful merchant, wants no part of this. Life is good. He tries to escape by boarding a ship, which encounters a storm. The sailors think it's because Jonah is on board, so they throw him overboard, where he, of course, is swallowed by a great fish, a whale, and then spit up, sent by the Lord, and then spit up on the shores of Nineveh. Still reluctant, he hears the word of the Lord and goes finally and prophesies to the citizens of Nineveh, who repent, and the city is saved. The author was trying to point out that the love of God, that the Lord God was the God of all people, not just the Hebrew people. And even the Ninevites, if they repented, were to be embraced in God's loving kindness. It was a major message from a so-called minor prophet, an early expression of universalism. But there is another dimension of this classic tale that really intrigues me even more. It was Jonah's reluctance to hear his Lord and his admonition to go and prophesy, to speak truth to power. Jonah tried to run away, but according to the Bible, God has the best parts, the most dominant parts always, and will not let him escape his divinely mandated mission. Psychologist Abraham Maslow, developed a whole theory about running from responsibility, which he called the Jonah complex. His point was that we tend to resist the call to our true vocation, resist doing what we might do when we are at our very best. Maslow wrote, "We are afraid to become what we can become, that which we can glimpse in our best moments. We enjoy and even thrill to the godlike possibilities we see in ourselves in peak moments. And yet we simultaneously shiver with weakness, awe, and fear before these very same possibilities." I think of the story of a man at a Unitarian Universalist revival. He worked himself up into a frenzy, if you can imagine it, and then said, "Use me, O Lord, use me, O Lord, use me, O Lord," in an advisory capacity. However, these times call for much more than being used in an advisory capacity. Sometimes I think Unitarian Universalists are better talking the talk than walking the walk. Or if they do walk, they often, too often, walk away from their mission. So this is a sermon about breathing together, which literally means conspiracy to breathe together. The definition of conspiracy. So I invite you to be part of a conspiracy to repair the world. And furthermore, I think that I'm going to...
Uni?
Well, what is that? I'm in the middle of the sermon.
It's the Lord, Uni.
The Lord? Don't you have the wrong number? You don't want to talk to me. I mean, I'm a Unitarian Universalist.
That doesn't bother me, Uni. I'm after a promise to speak the liberating word.
But Lord, I'm such a ragtag collection of meanings and values. What would you want of me? I'm such a minority of minorities. What could I do for you or for life?
I've always worked with minorities, Uni, from the very beginning. It seems to go better that way. Majorities are so apt to become arrogant. There's something zestful about a minority which dares to confront the conventional wisdom. There's something about a minority which dares to claim if it doesn't know all the answers. There's something about a minority. It is leaven in my loaf. I like minorities when they're sincere, when they're committed.
But I'm small and weak.
Uni, where was the strength of Michael Servetus and Hosea Ballou, Ralph Waldo Emerson and Margaret Fuller, John Haynes Holmes and Susan B. Anthony? They were of your flock, and they did not put me off. They willingly joined my stable of prophets.
But they're historical figures, Lord, great leaders. I'm only an ordinary Unitarian Universalist.
Uni, do you think history stopped with them? You're part of history, too. You're living in it.
I'm living in history?
Of course. You've been doing it, and you never noticed. Who do you think is going to make history for the next generation?
I don't know. Certainly not me.
Why not?
Well, for one thing, Lord, I'm very busy. I have conferences to attend, and back home fences to mend, and miles to go before I sleep.
But what of the promises to keep?
Tell you what, Lord. Make me a prophet. But not quite yet.
When then, my friend? Prophets are hard to find these days. The hour grows late. When wilt thou speak the liberating word? I am waiting.
Well, sorry for that interruption, but never can tell what happens in New Hampshire. Well, it's been said that Unitarian Universalism doesn't interfere with either your politics or your religion. But I beg to differ. It interferes and should interfere, I think, with both. And it's hard enough to walk the tightrope of politics and religion in ordinary times, but it is exceedingly difficult when increasingly we are up to our steeples in politics. So if religion is that core of meanings, values, and convictions out of which we live our life, then being a citizen comes out of those same core values. What gives meaning to our lives, the values that inform those lives, and the convictions out of which we live and make our commitments in society. Otherwise, we become a behavioral schizophrenia with head and heart and hands all going in different directions. Our own Theodore Parker, that great prophetic preacher of the 19th century, said, "Shall justice fall and perish out of the world? Shall wrong continually endure? Injustice cannot stand. No armies, no alliances can hold it up." And then these classic words. "The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice." But does the moral arc of the universe bend toward justice? Is it automatic? Inexorable? Parker knew, and we know, that it is we who must do the bending. His prophetic words are true only if we Unitarian Universalists learn to walk the talk, to what I call the prophetic imperative in the 21st century. To breathe together, to conspire, to serve, if not to save, the world. As I look at the many issues that surround us, I think of one of my favorite stories about the Army Scout who was sent out by his commanding officer to spy on, to survey the enemy position, to determine what tactics were to be followed henceforth. And the scout went out and returned some hours later and says, "There's good news, sir. We can attack on any front. We're surrounded." That's the way I feel. And I could give you a well-worn and well-known catalog of injustices, from war to environmental degradation, from Katrina to a federal budget that rewards the rich and punishes the poor. But to sum it up, I encountered a 21st century parable just last week. From Canandaigua, New York, the chosen spot in Iroquois, where I went to high school. My mother, who was insisted living there, had a chance to go and see President George W. Bush, who came to speak on Medicare Part D, the drug benefit, supposedly. The interesting thing was, she was presumably locked down from 9 to 2 in her room, being a bomb thrower that she is. But she was, with her fellow residents, bused over to Canandaigua Academy, where the president was to speak and lead a panel discussion. And she did get there. And what was fascinating was that there was a warm-up act before the president arrived in the big panel. Canandaigua Academy students who were doing the musical Music Man. And the song that they chose to sing, I don't know if this is by accident or what, but it was, "We Got Trouble. We Got Trouble Right Here in River City." The irony was exquisite. So we do have our work cut out for us. As one Middle East rabbi said, the next 10 years will be the most difficult. They always have been. So what will be the Unitarian Universalist response? Let me share with you two recent articles that give me the theological and political shivers that have serious implications for our conspiracy. Item, New York Times, March 8, 2004. College for the Homeschooled is shaping leaders for the right. Patrick Henry College in Virginia is a college primarily for evangelical Christian homeschoolers, but it is also a pipeline into conservative politics. Of the nearly 100 interns working in the White House in the spring of 2004, 7 were from the roughly 240 students enrolled. An 8th intern worked on the president's reelection campaign. What are we doing to prepare our young people to translate their Unitarian Universalist values into work for the beloved community? Item, Washington Post, February 16, 2004. Falwell's Fast Talkers for Christ. It seems that Jerry Falwell, Chancellor of Liberty University, is preparing his students to defend their brand of Christian theology and Christianity in the secular culture. As a result, the debate team at Liberty University is one of the best debate teams in the country. It is, in his words, the most important of our 18 sports. At the national championship in the spring of 2003, and I quote, "Liberty racked up more points than any other school, including such prestigious institutions as Harvard, Dartmouth, Northwestern, and Cornell." New York Times recently featured members of that debate team in an article. Again, I ask, what are we doing to prepare our young people to articulate and defend their faith and the social justice values we espouse? So what happens when the might of the religious right meets the heft of the religious left? Well, the truth is, there isn't a great deal of heft in the religious left, sad to say. And there are times when people like me tend to repair to St. Jude, patron saint of lost causes, or perhaps to St. Rita, patroness of impossible cases. Or if you prefer a more literary allusion, there is Cervantes' Don Quixote, tilting at windmills and consistently being dehorsed. I embraced all three images myself. I had that feeling a week ago yesterday as I stood in the freezing cold at Lafayette Square in downtown Buffalo, invigorated by the bracing breezes from Lake Erie at about 20 degrees of temperature and probably below zero wind chill, as we witnessed to the third anniversary of the war in Iraq, making our protest with what seemed to be an implacable administration. The war seems to be going on and on and on, but we did witness. Then to add insult to injury, there's a Gary Trudeau Doonesbury cartoon that unearths a very difficult issue for Unitarian Universalists in the ultra-conservative world of religion and politics. Zonker, the 60s radical, is in the radio studio watching TV. Fox News, "We report, you decide." He responds, "That has to be the most cynical slogan in the history of journalism." His fellow talk show host Harvey, the conservative, chimes in. "Drives you crazy, doesn't it? You know why? Because you liberals are hung up on fairness. You actually try to respect all points of view. But conservatives feel no need whatsoever to consider other views, so we roll you guys every time." Zucker ponders as Harvey pauses and finally says, "Actually, you make a good point." Which Harvey grins and says, "See, only a loser would admit that." A caricature to be sure, and some of my best friends are conservatives, and probably many right in this congregation, but it does cause one to reflect about our emphasis on our values as Unitarian Universalists. Robert Frost once said that liberals are those who can't take their own side in a quarrel. So, are we too tolerant, too open, too nice, too wishy-washy? Do we expose our children to other faiths so generously that they can't articulate their own faith tradition? Are we so open to other views, so cautious in the fear of being dogmatic, so enamored of the ambiguity and ambivalence of all the issues, that we are in fact steamrolled by those in religious and political life who are absolutely convinced that God has told them what to do? Because the Bible tells them so, perhaps, if they're in religious circles, or if they're in politics because, well, Karl Rove told them so. In its root meaning, liberalism means openness, humility, generosity of spirit, neighborliness, loving compassion toward the other, the stranger, even the enemy. Are these values dysfunctional in the hardball religious politics of the 21st century? What to do? One, we need to re-examine in our congregation the elusive, controversial, troubling, and empowering relationship between politics and religion. Are we going to allow the might of the religious right to overwhelm the minuscule heft of the religious left because we individualists of faith can't seem to get our act together? Can we preserve our treasured community, our vaunted theological and religious and political pluralism, and still be effective players in the public square? Will we ever get serious about enacting and implementing General Assembly resolutions, for example? How can we be a prophetic voice and still honor our pluralism? In the workshop this week, we'll have, I hope, some answers. Two, we need to explore the role of a movement predominantly, though not exclusively, of the haves in society, in a society with so many have-nots. Dare we sometimes call the technicians and bureaucrats of the establishment to confront our own complicity with what has happened in our nation to the dispossessed among us? As a 19th century U.S. Senator and Unitarian, Charles Sumner, put it, "There are appetites without dinners at one end of the table, and dinners without appetites at the other." It's true then, and it is true now. So can we find the courage to confront our own privilege and transform our resources of time, talent, and treasure into work for the beloved community? Will we help our children wonder why they go to some of the best schools in the nation, while in other schools, and I can cite some in Rochester, New York, they do not even have textbooks? Three, we need to recast political and moral dialogue to broaden this nation's understanding of what moral values are, rooted in love and inclusion, not hate and exclusion. We need to reframe the issues in as effective a way as the religious right has framed those issues. University of California linguist George Lakoff provides instruction in this. For example, he says, partial birth abortion, used often by the religious right in their anti-choice efforts, is not even a medical term. They made it up. And yet, even on NPR, I hear the term used now from time to time. Tax relief suggests that somebody, this is New Hampshire, don't tread on me, this is a good image. Tax relief suggests that there are people oppressing me by having their foot on my neck, even as we prepare, Congress prepares to extend tax cuts for wealthy. The word marriage is narrowly defined and drips with homophobia, and the 11 anti-same-sex marriage initiatives that passed in November of 2004. I understand this issue came to the New Hampshire legislature, and your clergy, among others, spoke out, and the measure was defeated. Good for you. The No Child Left Behind slogan was stolen from the Children's Defense Fund, and has a very different vision. And I don't hear too much talk about compassionate conservatism anymore. So we need to define the culture of life as including the need to keep abortion safe, legal, and rare. We need to remind ourselves, and in the words of Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, a Unitarian, taxes are the price we pay for civilization. And they are, I would add, our investment in the common good. We need to proclaim that in a world so full of hate, loneliness, and despair, we ought to be grateful when we see expressions of committed affection and love, whatever their family organization may be. We need to project our nation as that city on the hill, not the empire on the ground. And finally, fourth, we need to educate and train all of our people, and particularly the young, in how to become prophetic witnesses for peace, justice, equity, and compassion. The religious right, my friends, is way ahead of us here. We've got a lot of catching up to do. Can we help maintain in our youth the decency of liberal values we hope to instill in them, and at the same time educate them to be effective spokesmen for the prophetic imperative, who will not be rolled by the religious right? The danger is, in the words of baseball great Leo DeRocher, nice guys finish last. Let's hope it's not true. So in sum, we need to become a prophetic church where we can walk the talk, to become a prophetic church which will, like Jonah, finally listen to our mission. We must resist the temptation to give in to the cynicism and despair that is manifold in our land today. We need a spiritual and moral gut check if we are to become the kind of nation we would like to become. I take heart, and I suspect most of you are Red Sox fans, I take heart in that amazing fall of 2004 when the Red Sox literally snatched victory from the jaws of defeat by beating those Yankees. So I'm an anti-Yankee fan, I must say. Incredible metaphor for the way people can rally when the cause looks grim. E.B. White has written that democracy is a score at the beginning of the ninth, so the game is not over. Well, politicians come and go. Parties win and lose, but life abides. In birth, suffering, joy, and death. The ultimate human issues persist even as these public issues swirl about our heads, distracting us and engaging us. And the church grapples with both kinds of issues, both those immediate issues of life and death and suffering and meaning, and those wider issues of the greater world. Comforted by this perspective, I once again turn myself to what has been called the humdrum work of democracy, knowing with Annie Dillard that there is no one but us. Another poet, Wendell Berry, finally gives us courage in his little poem, The Real Work. It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work. And that when we no longer know which way to go, we have come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sinks. And we're going to sing This Little Life, number 118. Let's hear it.